Well, if you like good endings, chapter 12 was a better one. I mean, if you missed it, you should have been here last week for the feel-good celebrations, the wild rejoicing, as the people of God reveled in their identity, dedicated the wall that now protected them, but more than that, dedicated themselves as the people of God's book. Cue happy memories, fitting climax, they all lived happily ever after. Only they didn't. And Nehemiah had to write, and we have to face chapter 13. It is one of history's great anticlimaxes. Actually, pretty much everything you don't want from religion is here. I mean, the opening paragraph even sounds so exclusive and intolerant, and by verse 3 you could really add racist. When the people heard this law, they excluded from Israel all who were of foreign descent. And Nehemiah himself seems a different man from earlier in the book. You really do feel no more Mr. Nice Guy. We discover in verse 6 that he'd had a break from Jerusalem. He'd served a dozen years as governor. He'd then returned to the king, something he may have been away for up to 15 years, before this chapter tells of his second term in office. They say never go back, don't they? I don't know whether anyone gave Nehemiah that advice, but he's certainly an older man now. And, you know, when people get older, sometimes the restraints start slipping, the brakes get weaker in what they say and do. And, well, like many others as well, the thought of legacy and what he leaves behind could have been filling his mind, and his legacy is crumbling. He certainly cuts an authoritarian figure with the I very dominant all through this chapter. I mean, just look at it. Look at verse 8. I threw out. Verse 9. I ordered. Verse 11. I rebuked. Verse 15. I warned. Verse 25. I rebuked. I called curses down on them. I beat them. I pulled out their hair. Verse 28, I drove him away from me. And all the time, he still manages to sound what seems like sort of smugly self-righteous with those prayers that creep in verse 14, remember me. In verse 21, remember me. Verse 31, remember me. But before we write him off as just a difficult old man, or judgmental and full of himself, we may need to check out our own assumptions. Listen to Jim Packer put it this way. Was it a weakness that in Nehemiah's code of conduct, the modern shibboleth, thou shalt be nice, seems to have had no place? While thou shalt be faithful to God and zealous for God was evidently basic to it. Would Moses, David, Jesus, or Paul ever have qualified as Mr. Nice Guy? The assumption so common today that niceness is of the essence of goodness needs to be exploded. Nehemiah should not be criticized for thinking that there are more important things in life than being nice. I mean, that's something to chew over, isn't it? Actually, I think we can conclude that Nehemiah didn't always handle his anger the best way and still recognize it comes from a heart outraged by all that obscured God's name or took the missional edge off a people called to bring his name and his light to the nations. It's an anger more godly than we often give him credit for. But when you read some of these narrative bits of the Bible, they aren't always calling us to do what the people there did. They don't necessarily commend them. They're just telling you this is what happened. I don't know that we're called to do what Nehemiah did. Pulling hair out is not part of our pastoral care program. But I do believe we're called to take seriously what Nehemiah took seriously. And there's a genuine pastoral leadership that calls people back to Bible truths they've signed up to and are now drifting away from. And the people of Nehemiah's day had written down, pledged, and signed up to obeying all the commands of the Lord their God. And they named three specifics that we mentioned last week involving family life and business life and church life, temple life. And those were precisely the three that are being broken when Nehemiah comes back and sees what's going on. So he sets about once more restoring the distinctiveness of the people of God. And he begins in the temple, what I've called church life renewed. Now, Tobiah, who's a central figure in this opening section, he's been a thorn in the side, a pain in the neck throughout the book. He's one of the leading enemies of the people. Time and again, he'd schemed to frustrate their plans and keep them as weak and vulnerable as possible. He'd planned a military invasion. He'd hired a hitman to take out Nehemiah. He'd kept up a stream of demoralizing and insinuating correspondence to the movers and shakers of Jerusalem. But he was well connected. In fact, he was related to some of the most powerful figures in the city. And now with Jerusalem restored, he wheedles his way into a prime site city flat in the temple itself. All the religious paraphernalia are moved out and his furniture moved in. Thank you very much. The enemy of God, living in the temple of God, and put there by the priest of God, Eliashib, in charge of the storeroom. And of course, he doesn't stop there. With the storeroom occupied, people stopped bringing offerings. I mean, there was nowhere to put them. So the Levites, the teachers of the word, had nothing to live on. They went back to their fields, and the ministry of the temple was running down. What are you expecting Nehemiah to do? See, no wonder verse 8. I was greatly displeased. And I threw all Tobiah's household goods out of the room. I mean, you can picture it, can't you? You know, the cases, the clothes, the gadgets scattered over the front lawn. And he follows it up by reinstating temple offerings and ministry. By verse 11, he says, "So I rebuked the officials and I asked them, 'Why is the house of God neglected?' And then I called them together and stationed them at their posts." Of course, it's all different now. I mean, we're New Testament Christians. There's no temple for a start, though when Jesus came, there was one. And he sorted it out in drastic fashion too, overturning tables, cleaning out traders. How dare you turn my father's house into a market? But the temple, the place that represents God's meeting place with his people, is not a building now, not even a fine one like this. It's a congregation, it's a church family, it's people. God is in us. And there are great warnings too in the New Testament to protect his people from those who oppose and twist his word. And they're not mealy-mouthed warnings. Have nothing to do with. Warn, avoid, refute, rebuke. Of course, it's quite hard to imagine a Tobiah allowed too close a position to a Christian congregation these days. Now, actually, it's quite easy to imagine it, isn't it? We live in a day and age when a cathedral allows the Quran to be read in a service the other week, and the reader includes a verse that, in effect, denies that Jesus is God's son. We live in a day and age when ministers are appointed across the historic denominations who flout or despise or ignore God's book. We live in a day and age where you can find churches and chapels across the land that have been sold to property developers, used as warehouse or entertainment centers, even occasionally handed to other faiths as their places of worship. Why is the house of God neglected? And now, as then, money and ministry are linked. People vote with their wallets. At our PCC meeting last Monday, We got some good news as the finance team gave us their first look at the finance figures for the whole of last year. And your giving resourced all our ministries last year and seems to have left us with a small surplus. Thank you so much for your generosity. The not-so-good news came a little later in the PCC meeting when we looked at some of our risks we face as a church, and finance was one of them because it's a small handful of people who give a huge percentage of the income. They may not be the most generous people here. They may have millions to give it out of. But they do give a huge percentage. And if you're one of them, thank you very much. Stay healthy, stay at All Souls. Just in case you hadn't worked out the lesson. Actually, what Nehemiah does is to encourage all Judah to bring their tithes. The responsibility is on all of us. Church life renewed. But when the church has lost its way and its faithful witness, it's going to affect more than just our religious life. So you see, next you find Nehemiah tackling business life. Business life regulated. Sabbath trading laws had been one of the distinctives of the people of God, that they kept a day of rest for their God. They didn't impose it on other nations around them, but it marked them out. It was a day for their rest and recreation. It was a day to be a reminder that we're not made for this world. It's a day to remind them they were a rescued people and to stop and say thank you. They did not live a 7-day a week, make as much as I can, can't trust my God to provide existence. Sabbath stopped them in their tracks every week. Faced them with the question, is my work, is my career, in their days, is my farm, all there is to life? And they pledged to keep the Sabbath and not to trade with others on that day, just a few chapters back. And now traders were ignoring those laws and the nobles, the powers that be, were turning a blind eye. So what is Nehemiah going to do? Verse 17. I said to them, what is this wicked thing you're doing, desecrating the Sabbath day? Now, I know it doesn't sound very wicked to our ears, but it was a policy that had had a disastrous track record in Israel's recent history. And Nehemiah pointed out to them. And as the traders queued up and poured into Jerusalem, and the people no doubt said the way people always do, you know, what's the harm? That's a family day. Yeah, we'll go as a family to the garden center or down Oxford Street or wherever. Nehemiah saw the harm. The dangers as creeping materialism took the edge off their spiritual appetites. Of course, it's different now. We're New Testament Christians, and it wasn't an over-lax but an over-regulated Sabbath that colored Jesus' teaching. The Sabbath was made for man, he said, not man for the Sabbath. And Sabbath, of course, was a Saturday, and now Christians look to Sunday, and even the fiercest opponent of Sunday trading would draw the line at the bouncers that Nehemiah posted in verse 19. But Jesus warned very clearly of the dangers of materialism. You cannot serve God and mammon, he said. Not you should not. Not you must not. Not it's very hard to serve God and mammon. But you cannot serve God and mammon. You can't pull it off. Now, he knows the way our minds work. See, we don't throw God overboard in one step. We want to keep hold of God. Of course we do. We just want everything else as well. The hard-pressed businessman sees himself as a church stalwart, but can't let go of work, drifts from hard-working to workaholic, probably needs to hear, you cannot serve God and be a workaholic. If we don't take our Sabbath What dependence on God do we show? That's too close to home for many of us. See, church life renewed is going to affect everything else. Here's business life regulated, and it may be some of us, many of us, need to start imposing our own regulations for ourselves. And then Nehemiah turns to the third issue, solemnly pledged and carelessly broken, what I've called family life reset. And that's verses 23 to 28. Now, understand the real issue here. It's about religion, not race. It's about whether the God of Israel is the one true living God or just their God, the same way as everyone else's gods is their God. The fears about Ammonites and Moabites in that opening paragraph of the chapter aren't founded on racism, on the color of their skin, but their attitude to God and his people. God sets his face against multi-faith worship. And mixed marriages are picked on here because they bring this issue in by the back door. And history had proved the point, never more clearly than in the case of Solomon in verse 26. Even he was led into sin by foreign women who brought their foreign gods with them and sucked more than just Solomon into worship of them. Actually, of course, there's always been a place for the foreigner in the people of God, in the pages of the Old Testament as well as the New Testament. In fact, in the pages of this book, Nehemiah has foreigners eating at his table. And the Old Testament book of Ruth, which Johnny Dyer is opening up for us on Sunday evenings, it's the story of a Moabite woman who joined and was accepted into the people of God, and all because of her mother-in-law. Your people will be my people, she said, and your God will be my God. And the book of Nehemiah makes room for any like that. It speaks about all who separated themselves from the neighboring peoples. And when the New Testament opens, it does so, you may remember, with a list that takes us down a family tree from Abraham all the way to Jesus. And there, proudly and deliberately included, is Ruth, the Moabite woman. What Nehemiah's seizing on is the danger of Israel losing her distinctiveness as the people of God through mixed religion marriages, and in particular, the effect it has on the next generation. Look at verse 24. See, half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod or the language of one of the other peoples and did not know how to speak the language of Judah. You don't need a lot of imagination to see how it comes about, do you? Mother's influence very strong at home. The children aren't bilingual. They grow up speaking the language she speaks to them. It makes you wonder what communication there was between husband and wife, actually. I think marriage counselors might have had a field day then. But here is the children he looks at. And if the children can't speak the language in which the scriptures were written and read to the people, how will they learn of the God the scriptures reveal and come to know him? Which God will the next generation serve? Of course, it's different now, and we're New Testament Christians, and ethnic distinctions are swept away within Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. Actually, it's what we rejoice in, isn't it, as we come together and look around and see all kinds of ethnic backgrounds and know that we're united in Christ Jesus. But the New Testament teaches that if you marry, share your bed with someone who shares your gospel. Paul writes to the Corinthians and says, she's free to marry anyone she wishes, but he must belong to the Lord. He says, do not be yoked together with unbelievers. Because that's a recipe for pain and hurt and a sliding away from the Lord. There are some beliefs that are core to who we are. And they need to be shared beliefs if a marriage is going to pull in the same direction. All of us here for whom marriage is still a future prospect, we need to reset your thinking, your dreaming, your dating, if you haven't included this truth into your planning. And parents here need to include it in the wisdom we pass on to our children. And not just brush it aside in our enthusiasm for any partner our children might bring home. Church life renewed, business life regulated, family life reset. You understand, don't you, now why I said chapter 12 would have made a better ending? Yeah, that's where you could have written, they all lived happily ever after, and we like they all lived happily ever after endings. Chapter 13 faces us up to an uglier and more challenging question the church must face, the challenge of semper reformanda, of always going on being reformed, of continually bringing ourselves back to God's values, to the holiness we find in God's book, because we're made of similar stuff to the people of Nehemiah's day. Look, as many of you know, 2017 is the 500th anniversary of the start of the Protestant Reformation. It was the end of October when Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of Wittenberg Cathedral. When you speak of a 500th anniversary, it kind of suggests, doesn't it, an event that was done and accomplished and finished. The reality is that this side of Christ's return, we will need semper reformanda, always to go on being reformed. Yeah, chapter 12 would have been a happier ending. Chapter 13 faces us up to an important reality. Welcome to Christian ministry. It never ends. We need to go on keeping on picking each other up, calling each other back to walking God's ways. A church is never reformed full stop. It always needs to go on being reformed. It's true for individuals as well. Roger Salisbury, former colleague here, always used to say, I keep trying to encourage people to make sure they take the next step as they go on in life. He said the number of people who've been wonderfully following God's way till they're 30 and then it just slackens off. Or they do it till they're sort of 50 and then it slackens off. Or they do it till retirement and then it slackens. Now you need to go on always being called back to following God. Which is why it's hard to tell what legacy you leave behind, other than a church, people that'll need to go on being reformed. Did Nehemiah's reforms work second time round? Did they last? Hard to tell. I mentioned that at the PCC meeting we'd had an item looking at the risks we face as a church. It's really trustees doing what trustees of any charity need to do and look at the risks. So we looked at the obvious ones. You know, do we have the right things in place if there was a fire or an emergency, if there was some terrorist act? We talked about finances. And after the meeting, some of us were chatting, and one PCC member came up brilliantly and she said, actually, the highest risk for us as a church is that we stop being faithful to the gospel. Yet that would blow everything else. That's the highest risk. The next PCC will make sure that's included as the top risk and stays there. Very healthy when you're talking about risk management to realize that's the biggest one. Nehemiah would have included it. Remember me, he says. And I don't think it is Nehemiah being full of himself. I think it's Nehemiah knowing how uncertain his fruitfulness is. I think it's Nehemiah's plea, not about the legacy he left, but about the legacy he might receive. I think it's Nehemiah's appeal to the only one whose verdict counts. I think it's actually an appeal to his faithfulness, even if he can't be sure of fruitfulness. I think it's an appeal for mercy there. Remember me with favor, my God. Remember me. An appeal, yes, to good, faithful things he had done, whatever they had or hadn't come to. Of course, someone says, yes, but I've failed too often. Where I'm starting from, there aren't good things to appeal to. Well, come to the cross. Come to that penitent thief on the cross beside Jesus who can only pray, remember me. No good things to add. Can only do what Nehemiah does, throw himself on the mercy of this God, my God. Remember me when you come in your kingdom. Look, as a church, All Souls, Langham Place. I mean, others may speak of our size, our strength, our fruitfulness, and I thank God where there's truth there. But be under no illusions. All Souls, Langham Place is in need of semper reformanda, of always being reformed, the same as any other church. This last hymn we're going to sing is a prayer. It may well be a prayer that as individuals we need to pray. Actually, I'd be worried if we didn't think it was a prayer for us individually. But very definitely, it is a prayer for all souls as a church to pray. Lord of the church, we pray for our renewing.